You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear about a new initiative at a Wisconsin university that allows veterans to use their military experience to get credits for information technology degrees.
First, Governor Scott Walker signed Senate Bill 459 into law yesterday. The legislation changes regulations for wetlands and waterfront property.
We'll hear from an advocacy group shortly about the concerns they have about this legislation. But first, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, Sean Johnson, joins us to tell us about what is and is not in the newly signed law. Sean, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Sean, walk us through what's changing with this new bill, otherwise known as Senate Bill 459.
So there was a lot that went into this bill when it was first introduced, and a lot having to do with wetlands and with boathouses was another topic that kept coming up in this bill. I think broadly speaking, it shifts the balance from regulators and scientists at the DNR when it comes to wetland issues to private property owners. And so it was introduced as part of what was deemed a private property package by Republican lawmakers at the time. And so, you know, for example, when it comes to boathouses, people that have those wouldn't have to, seek permits every time they want to repair the boathouse. When it comes to dredging artificial bodies of water that don't connect with like a natural lake or stream, people would have more power to do that. And it would really limit the Department of Natural Resources' power to step in and stop construction of single-family homes or expansions of barns when it comes to, projects that are on or near wetlands.
And I understand that piers are part of this whole picture as well.
Anything that, when you start to talk about construction on private property and adjacent to, navigable waters, there's a lot in this bill.
And Governor Walker tweeted some thoughts about this one recently. He said, and here's a quote from his tweet, "Property owners should be able to improve and enjoy their property in a reasonable manner without unclear and overbearing regulations." So what kinds of things was he referring to when he said unclear and overbearing in terms of regulations?
I think you probably hear the governor use those words a lot when he refers to regulation. And so, that dovetails with this whole idea that what they were doing was aimed at improving the rights of private property owners. I think if you look at the package as a whole, especially as it was introduced, it is something that caught a pretty broad array of environmental groups. Made them pretty unhappy, especially with what it said initially when it comes to dredging a natural lake bed.
And what did it say?
Well, and I guess in those cases, it gave property owners a lot more power over what has always been viewed as public waters in Wisconsin. So, we have in Wisconsin and in other states this public trust doctrine that says that the lakes and the streams, the state's navigable waters shall be common highways and forever free. It's very lofty language, but it essentially says that those lakes and those streams belong to everyone. And when it came to lakes for adjacent landowners, it was going to give those landowners much more power to dredge without having to go through a rigorous review by a DNR scientist. And so that would have been a huge change. It was taken out by Republicans in the state Senate who were a little uneasy with it, namely Senator Robert Coles of Green Bay. And so that was the most controversial provision. It was taken out, but in the end, you still have a bill that makes a number of changes with how the state treats wetlands and, structures along waters.
We'll talk more about this with our next guest, but what does dredging do and why would a property owner want to dredge?
A property owner might want to dredge because it's harder to get a boat through. It's not as much fun for them to swim. You know, I think the stories you heard from property owners who said that they wanted to do this were what was that, the lake home that they vacationed at when they were kids just wasn't the same anymore, that they used to be able to swim there, they used to be able to enjoy it, and they can't anymore. And so they wanted the power to be able to dredge that up. Environmental groups said, hold on a second, when you're talking about lakes, it's a lot different than water in a river, and the ecosystems are far more fragile, and you might damage a lot of fish habitat. And so, those concerns ultimately won the day in the legislature.
And Sean, another aspect of this that we haven't touched on yet, stormwater ponds. What was called for there?
So stormwater ponds was, I think that's the part that is, you know, I'm not familiar with that part. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there and we'll go to our next guest. Sean, thank you so much
Sorry
for joining
that.
Us to share with us. That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. And we turned on to Erin O'Brien. She is the Policy Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Erin, what was your first response to these new provisions in the law?
Well, like many organizations, we were very concerned about what was proposed. And, of course, as Sean did a great job describing, this is a fairly large package with a lot of different provisions, and a number of them specifically addressed protections for wetlands, which is, of course, our organization's primary concern.
And in terms of what is and is not, what ended up in the final form of the bill, what occurs to you? What issues do you have with it?
Well, first I'll say we were really pleased to see the provisions that Sean mentioned related to dredging of nearshore habitats removed, because that one had really widespread implications for lakes and the many, many wetlands that that are in those nearshore environments. So what remained were some provisions that unfortunately still make it easier for landowners to get permission to develop in wetlands. And the concerns are many, certainly ecological concerns, but the way this bill is characterized as something that's a benefit to landowners is really two-sided, because these provisions, in fact, could be detrimental to landowners, because it encourages a kind of development without good planning that could cause them to develop in ways that cause them or other landowners or members of their community problems later on.
What kinds of water-adjacent development are you concerned about with the new bill?
Well, first, I guess let me say this. You know, one of the reasons we traditionally have laws that don't allow unfettered development in privately owned wetlands is because these wetlands provide many public benefits. And what this law addresses, this new law, is really looking at smaller projects on lands that are privately owned and improvements, or I should say development activities that that are wanted or desired by that private landowner, so a homeowner or a small business. Unfortunately, you know, building in wetlands can put people, property, and public infrastructure at risk, and it also has implications for our lakes, rivers, and streams that are downstream from those areas. And the reason is because that wetlands form on the landscape where there is a need to manage water. So wetlands help help regulate the movement of that water, and they also help that water be clean. So when we start developing in wetlands, we like to describe it, it's kind of like that game whack-a-mole. You know, we know how to find ways to build on areas where the land is wet or tends to be wet. Those are the wetlands. But that water still needs someplace else to go. So what happens is that, you know, the impacts or the consequences of that, they may not be felt by that individual landowner. They've gotten something that works for them, ideally, although, again, they may end up with a sump pump or some flooding or structural problems because that land still wants to be wet. But in addition to that, the impacts tend to be felt cumulatively to downstream landowners and downstream communities, and that's because when we start to fill wetlands here and wetlands there across the landscape, the result is that we have too much water displaced, so moving very quickly downstream, ending up in the wrong places and causing problems like flooding or erosion and soil loss along the way. And those are problems that can be both expensive for landowners and communities and also dangerous to public safety and infrastructure.
And Erin, as we wrap up, we mentioned earlier that Governor Walker had tweeted that the bills would remedy what he sees as unclear and overbearing regulations on property owners. Do you agree with that assessment? Was there some need to clarify existing law about this sort of situation?
Well, it's always a good idea to try to help make our laws more understandable to the regulated community, including private landowners. But that's there's a difference between doing that and changing the law or weakening the law. So in fact, from our perspective, we think that the changes that are going into effect are making the law less clear. And one of the reasons for that is because it's the latest in a series of policy changes that make the requirements we have in Wisconsin law different from and weaker than requirements for wetland protection under federal law. So it's getting more difficult for landowners to understand what's expected of them. That can have a lot of problems, including leading to unexpected violations. It's also going to result in a disproportionate impact on certain kinds of wetlands, specifically Wisconsin's isolated wetlands, which are some of our most important and vulnerable wetlands in the state.
Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Erin O'Brien is the policy director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. She joined us there for a look at bills that signed into law that will be giving property owners more power to develop waterfront lands. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new effort from Herzing University created an accelerated degree program for military veterans here in the state. We'll talk to the president of one of the school's Wisconsin campuses about how the program works.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Sherry Ackerman always loved art, but hid her interest and her work until retirement. Now she sells her paintings and helps other non-professional artists discover and nurture their own artistic skills.
Sherry Ackerman grew up surrounded by art. Her mother was a painter, her father a photographer.
When I was younger, I always liked to draw, but I never told anybody that I liked to draw. I was pretty intimidated. I did it in my bedroom. I did it, you know, after I finished. School was real easy for me. I'm not bragging. It's just I didn't study much. And so I had lots of free time, so I would draw.
Even as she hid her art, Sherry didn't stop making art. She even started painting.
I didn't start painting until I was 24, and I was pregnant, and I had this overwhelming urge to paint. So I painted, and I was terrible. I'm not just saying that. I really was terrible. But slowly, I just kept at it, teaching myself how to do it.
After a career teaching Spanish and Chinese, Sherry retired and signed up for a painting class. It's there that she got the confidence to enter her first exhibition.
The very first time I had enough guts to put a piece in a wrap, it was in Lake Mills. So I put a piece in and I didn't get a state award, but I got an honorable mention. I was so excited. I called everybody I knew. I called my first cousins to tell them I was so excited. And it gave me so much encouragement that somebody liked my work other than my friends and family. I didn't know that was possible. So it's really encouraging for an artist.
From her win, Sherry began exhibiting and even selling her work. She also became involved in the Wisconsin Regional Artists Association and poured her heart into its Tiny Treasures fundraiser, a showcase of original art in miniature.
They're 2.5 by 3.5 inch pieces, so they're very, very small. And the first thing that everyone objected to was having to paint small. But a lot of artists found out that painting small really helped them so that they would design it, paint it small, and then if they liked the composition, then they went bigger. So it turned out it helped a lot of people.
Sherry contributes some of her own pieces and has purchased several tiny treasures for herself. From her own experience, Sherry knows the meaning that winning an award can have for an artist.
I especially love getting the tiny treasures and seeing people who have never exhibited or sold anything win an award. And seeing them come up and get their award is so thrilling for me, and it's so thrilling for them. So yeah, I do feel I try to encourage people. I love going to art shows whether I'm in them or not. So
painting is no longer something Sherry hides. The walls of her home are covered in her work.
now it's in my blood. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't try to set my day up to allow time to paint. And if I don't, I feel like something's missing.
Sherry Ackerman is a painter and the coordinator of Tiny Treasures. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now a new program at Herzing University is making it easier for veterans to use their experience in the military as credits toward information technology degrees. The program is called Vet2IT.
Bill Vinson joins us now to talk about the program. He's the president of Herzing University's Madison campus. Bill, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, tell us how this Vets2IT program works. What happens?
What happened was when we got a call from the Department of Veterans Affairs who wanted us to work with their military medics and help RNs actually get into the field faster. They took us on a tour of the state of Wisconsin, and over the course of last year, we talked to a lot of veterans and helped military medics go into our Vet to RN program. While we did that and we got to help a lot of veterans, we just couldn't help but feel there's more we could do. And that's where the Vet to IT thing came, and we looked for opportunity and saw that there was a lot of need for IT veterans to get into the field faster, to work in network technician type jobs. So that's how we developed the Vet to IT program initiative.
How does their military experience for these veterans translate into college credit?
That's a great question. And a lot of veterans ask that. So they take a lot of classes and a lot of hands-on experience in the military. We looked at the outcomes of those classes and just lined them up with our classes and saw it really fits. They work as network technicians in the military. RNs work as military medics. They're in combat. They're doing the same jobs a civilian would do. We figured out by looking at the outcomes how to give them college credit for that.
They would be duplicating their effort, in effect, if they had to take those same classes to do stuff that they'd already been doing in practice in the military.
Exactly.
Like.
Yeah. So we're saving them time and money and getting them out in the civilian world working faster.
Let's look back at that Vet to RN program first for nursing, for military medics. What was the response? How many people signed up for this?
Yeah. When we rolled this out, we went on a tour of the state of Wisconsin and talked to vets who've served all over the world. And they were so excited that somebody was recognizing what they did. So the response was overwhelmingly excited, to tell you in a short statement. And we had about 17 starting our first class. We have limited number of seats that we can put in right now. And so we're at capacity, but every single one of them is excelling and in many cases outperforming their peers.
And as you mentioned, the Department of Veterans Affairs was part of the effort to instigate that first program. Is there a sense that veterans are having a hard time getting back into the workforce after they get out of the military? This is a way to not even really do them a favor, but to recognize their existing experience to streamline things for them.
That's what we wanted to do, is recognize what they're already doing. They've been trained. They should be able to get credit for this. And when you look at the outcomes, it falls right in line with what college credit is. So we use their Arts and Smarts transcripts and their ACE transcripts to make sure that we're given the right credit and doing this well. But every single one of them has thanked us and been very happy with it.
For the RN and medic side of things, I think everybody can picture what kind of skills are involved here. But for this IT program, what kind of skills are we looking at? What kind of hands-on stuff have they done in the military? Will they be doing through the Vet to IT program?
We all have computers. We all have issues with those computers. In the military, they're working on those. Whether they're working on the hardware or the software of those computers, that's what they're doing. And then that translates into any number of jobs here in Madison. Typically, the vets that come back home will work in their area, so they're contributing to this community by working in IT field. So any company has an IT department. They're working on the computers, making sure all of us can do our jobs.
Yeah, the veterans in both these programs are looking to get into civilian careers. On the demand side, is there a big demand for the nurses who come out of the Vet to RN program or the IT professionals come out of Vet to IT?
Yes, absolutely. The companies we work with, our advisory boards, have said hands down, if you get us people with these skills, we want to look at them. And the vets absolutely have those skills. So the vets come through and shine when you look at what they've done.
response to this new IT program? Are you hearing from a lot of veterans who want to sign on here?
Yeah, we just rolled this out about 2 weeks ago. And in doing that, the military teams and commanders and sergeants that we work with have immediately said, get this out to my team. How can I promote this? Come talk to them. So they're really excited about helping us get this going.
Are you hoping to grow both of these programs in future semesters?
Yes, absolutely. We think between our Madison, Brookfield, and Kenosha campus, there's a lot of opportunity just with the Vet to RN, Vet to IT, and then next to look at the business world, because they take a lot of leadership classes that I think could help them in business degrees.
So Vet to BA, maybe you can come up with a better
Battle
acronym.
Battlefront to Boardroom.
Okay.
That's kind of what we're looking at for
all
that.
Right. Still playing with that.
Yep. So that's kind of our next thing that we'll start to roll out.
And you're hearing demand from that from the business world.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks a lot for telling us about this.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
We've been talking to Bill Vinson, president of Herzing University's Madison campus. He joined us to talk about a new accelerated degree program for vets who want to earn information technology degrees.
Coming up, our guest takes stock of the challenges facing journalists today. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, it's this week's installment of Storytelling with Snap Judgment. Tonight, we'll hear about the feeling you get when your favorite songs, the songs of your youth, are introduced as oldies. That's coming up tonight after 7 on Snap Judgment.
First, as newsrooms cut staff and the industry tries to stay solvent in an increasingly fractured media landscape, our next guest wonders if it's all worth it. Bill Leaders is an award-winning reporter and editor. He's the former Money and Politics Director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council and associate editor at the Progressive magazine.
And he's served as a mentor for young journalists and broken big stories here in the state of Wisconsin. Bill Leaders recently wrote a piece for Milwaukee Magazine asking, is journalism still worth it? A question he asked himself, and he joins us now. Bill, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, Bill, you gave a talk about the top 10 good things about being a journalist back in the fall to a group of young, civic-minded high school students. But that it sounds like it launched you on this question. Well, what would I really tell someone if they wanted to know, should I go into journalism? And I'm a young person. I don't want you to answer that yet. I want to go through some of the things you consider. But I want to ask you first, what is the biggest change that you've seen for journalists today that was different when you began your career?
Well, things are unpredictable. You can't count on loyalty from the publications and the news outlets that you may be loyal to. There are constant cuts in newsrooms and broadcast as well as print. And, you know, it's just not a secure place of employment. The talk that I gave was for a group called Junior State of America, and it was actually in the State Assembly. It was really cool with speaking from the floor of the Assembly, and the place was packed. And I gave a speech about what was good about being a reporter, some of the things that I thought were positive about how you learn to be more broad-minded, and you see things from more than one side. You get to meet interesting people. You're tapped into the news. You develop an appreciation for accuracy and a bunch of other skills that come in useful. And afterwards, one of the students who was in attendance came up to me and said she was interested in being a journalist and asked if I had any advice. And thinking about it later, I probably should have said, don't do it. It's not worth it. You shouldn't be getting into this profession.
You really think you should have said that to her?
I think that's a defensible thing to say. At least people who are going into the profession need to know that it's tremendously difficult to get a job. And once you do have a job, you may find that it's a terribly unsecure position, particularly after you've demonstrated loyalty to an organization and you've acquired a good deal of expertise after you've been around for a couple, 3 decades doing the hard work of being a reporter. You become more expendable because you get paid a little bit more than some younger person who they can hire off the street. So those are the people they go after. When newsrooms look to make cuts, they try to go after their most senior staff because they get paid slightly less terribly. So, you know, that's something people need to know, that if you are loyal to your organization and you acquire a lot of experience, you're going to make yourself more expendable.
As we said, you're a veteran journalist. I'm surprised in a way to hear you saying this, because the press, the media, is a check and balance on the judicial and the legislative branch of the government. Doesn't somebody have to do that?
Oh, sure. And I think that, you know, I come around to the to a conclusion that it's a great job. It's the same thing as I was able to explain to him. There's a lot of really good things about it, and it's an exciting place to be. And the people who do get thrown out on the street, so to speak, after years of loyalty to an organization, the ones I've spoken to, don't regret that they went into the profession, and they just would love the chance to do one more story, to be part of people's lives in times of triumph and tragedy.
Now, and there's a story that we talked about in Central Time. I want to ask you about a new poll from the Media Insight Project found that only 6% of Americans trust the media. And I gather that's on par with the approval rating for Congress, which is considered pretty abysmal. What is your take on why that number is so low?
That makes me angry. I think that it's tremendously unfair to the profession that it is not recognized as an accurate and trustworthy source of information. It is. By and large, you can believe just about everything you read in the newspaper. People take care to get things right. Every journalist I know cares about getting things right. Every journalist has tremendous consequences if they get things wrong, even the littlest things. And yet people beat up on the profession all the time. I think a lot of it is just straight up ignorance. They're too damn lazy to read the newspaper, and they want to blame it on someone else. So they blame it on the reporter and say, oh, it's all a bunch of lies, you can't trust them. Well, that's crap. That's not true. It's not fair. The journalists I know don't deserve that. And maybe we need to push back a little against this ignorance in society, the people who want to beat up on the media because they're too damn lazy to read the newspaper and to educate themselves through the available local press.
And that number, that 6%, it's low. And I wonder if that's something that you see as being a new development, maybe tied to this presidential election cycle, or do you think this has been something that has been, you know, the trust steadily eroding over the years as you see it?
Well, you see in this election cycle, and I've written about this separately, how candidates are making a target of the media, particularly Donald Trump has really singled out the media as a villain and has actually, you know, instigated harassment of media members in his who come to watch him speak. And he does it because he is so untethered to the truth. He lies with such dexterity that he can't stand the idea of being held accountable for the things he says. And it's the media that's doing it to him. So he has to discredit the media so he continue to say whatever he feels like, whether or not it's true.
You were challenged on that on your Milwaukee Magazine piece. So one comment, if you care to read the comments, I don't know if you have, but I'm going to share one with you now. And one commenter saying, "Well, what are you getting in here, playing that this is only the Republicans?" As if the Bernie Sanders campaign and the Hillary Clinton campaign haven't done the same thing.
Oh, sure.
What do you say to that?
Oh, I'd say that's right. I think politicians across the board like to scapegoat the media because the media seeks to hold them accountable. And I agree with many of the criticisms that people would make of the Democratic candidates when it comes to deflecting responsibility by blaming the messenger.
We're talking with Bill Leaders right now, associate editor at The Progressive Magazine and a whole lot more, talking about his recent piece in the Milwaukee Magazine, asking the question, doing some soul searching and asking, is it worth it to be a journalist today? And Bill, getting back to you, what do you think, if you could talk to someone right now, one of these people who say they don't trust the media is not trustworthy, obviously something you feel passionately about, what would you say to them to try to convince them that they were wrong, that this is an institution, as it were, that deserved more trust?
Well, I say this in the piece, in the Milwaukee Magazine essay, and I've said it before, that if you have 2 hours of your life to spare educating yourself in a way that you will never forget, go to an event that you know is going to be covered in the media, whether it's a visiting speaker that you know is going to get media attention, some dignitaries coming through town, even go to the baseball game that you know is going to get written up in the paper. Go to an event, debate, a day of court testimony. Take copious notes, write up what you've seen, and then the next day compare what you've written to what appears in the paper, and you will never look down your nose at a newspaper reporter again.
So basically you're saying this job is hard.
No, I'm saying the job is hard, and also the people who do it are good. They get things right. They say things in a sensible way. They're clear. They've learned to communicate an event to a general audience in a sophisticated but simple way. It's, you know, try it. You're not going to be as good as the people that you think aren't any good at all.
I want to quote a line from your piece here. You say, today's newspapers have become places of pain. It's such a strong sentence. When I read that, I had to stop and read it over again. I assume maybe you're overstating it a little, but are you? Flesh that out. Why are they places?
When I wrote that line, I actually laughed because I think that's just kind of a funny way to put it. But yeah, there's a lot of pain in news organizations. You know, my friends who work for daily newspapers, you know, they have this insecurity. They have this this sense that, you know, first of all, they're not respected as much as they should be. Second, their jobs are not as secure as they should be. And then they've they're just not in a great place. They see their coworkers getting laid off, and they know, you know, they're offered these voluntary buyouts. You know, should they take it so someone else doesn't have to get forced out of the job? It's painful for management too. You know, I don't doubt that being a manager in a newsroom these days is a very painful job to have. You have to throw people out of work because that's the order that's coming down from above from the people who run newspapers, some of whom should not be allowed within 1,000 miles of a newsroom.
Is it different for you? You work for a magazine now. Is it different if you're at an online publication, a magazine, something like that?
Well, you know, there are other kinds of other media now that have sprung into being that, you know, the dynamic is a bit different. And I'm a newspaper person. You know, even though I'm writing for a magazine now and I work for a weekly alternative as a freelance writer, you know, I'm still fundamentally committed to print. And that's an area where we've seen a lot of cutback, a lot of pain. But here's the other side of it. The people who still have those jobs are really very good. The people who are still working in print media are survivors. They've kept their jobs because they're excellent at them. And we need to have some appreciation for that. I mean, reporters do a lot more now than reporters did in the past. Now, some of that is technological. You know, when I first started as a newspaper reporter 30 years ago, if I wanted to look up an article that had appeared in the local paper like 8 months before, I'd have to, you know, bike on over to the central library and pull up the microfilm and run it through the machine until I found the article after I located in the index. And then I had to, like, print it out and pay 10 cents for the pay. You know, that's the type of stuff I would do as a reporter that now is instantaneous, that anyone can do. And you have tremendous access to information where you can, get all sorts of information at the press of a keyboard. So we do a lot more than we've ever had to do, and we do it really well.
We're talking with Bill Leaders right now, longtime Wisconsin journalist and current associate editor at the Progressive Magazine. He recently asked himself the question, is a career in journalism still worth it?
And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Why do you think the public has low trust in the media these days? Do you rely on the media? If so, which media? How do you get your news? An actual paper copy of a newspaper online from a newspaper's website somewhere else? Are you a journalist yourself? What do you think about what Bill is saying about the job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post, find a link to Bill's article at the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation with veteran journalist Bill Leaders. He's the associate editor at the Progressive Magazine and the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. And he recently asked himself, in a Milwaukee Magazine piece, is journalism still worth it?
You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a member of the public, do you appreciate the work that journalists do, that the media does? What could they do better? And who are they? What media are you following? Old-fashioned newspapers, their online incarnations, these newfangled web journalism sources? And if you're a journalist, tell us about your job, what you think of it. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go right to our callers now. We've got Mark first in Suamico. Mark, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. What I was telling the screener was, I think the general public is really fighting a battle with the different sources of media that where they get their news from, or at least their perception of what is news and really what isn't news, and making that, using critical thinking and determining what is actually news and what isn't. I use my mother-in-law as an example, who lives just north of Portage. And, you know, it's a fairly remote area, and she lives by herself, and she finds herself listening to conservative talk radio, which there may be some validity in the information she's getting, but when I go to visit her periodically, what I'll get are some of these amazing stories, what she considers to be news, and I go back to, and I'm not a journalist, but I think back to the time when I was actually writing articles for a paper that I worked for, you know, and checking sources, and I find myself asking her, well, what sources did they, kind of cite,
Mark, thanks a lot. I want to make sure we get Bill in on this. So what do you say to that, Bill, about making sure that your sourcing is reputable and that someone has done the footwork and checked their facts?
Yeah, well, different media have different standards and different degrees of reliability. I think newspapers are very much at the top in terms of reliability. They do check things much more scrupulously. They have editors who are overseeing the process. They have reporters who are trained to get things right. And there's a consequence to pay if you get something wrong. Sometimes I think on cable television, people say whatever they want, and if they're totally wrong, there's no price to pay. That's not the way it is in print media. So I put a higher, I have a higher regard for the accuracy of print media than other media, but different media do things well. Like, radio is the best forum for a significant discussion on an issue. If you have more than one voice and you want the interaction, it's the best medium for that. Television is the best medium for some other stories that have a visual component and where you want to show people something as well as tell them what is happening.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. And we go next to Joan in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. I think that journalists are very important, and I'm grateful because honest journalists bring to light things that make our government officials accountable, or at least to the point where they should be. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Leader, for what you do, because that is exactly what you do. And people like you who are honest journalists and bring these issues to the forefront.
Well, thank you. But don't thank me. Thank every journalist, every reporter, and support your local newspaper. Subscribe to your local newspaper. Support it that way. That's great. Thank you.
I wonder real quickly, Bill, I mean, what do you think the mentality of those in journalism is right now? Is it a besieged mentality? Is it as ever? How would you describe it?
Well, I will speak for myself and say that I am disgusted to some extent with the lack of respect that journalists get from certain quarters, including people like Donald Trump. I think that's just abhorrent that the people who do this job are treated as punching bags by punks like that. But overall, I think, we encounter all kinds of people. We encounter people who are tremendously grateful that we cover their issues and events and tell their stories. And we tap into that, too. Gratitude is something we very often encounter in our work. So, it's all over the place.
Joan, thanks a lot for that. And we go next to Terry calling us in Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Hello, Joan. How are you? I just wanted to comment, I'm a former radio news reporter and had a short stint in TV producing as well. And I went into journalism and, wanted to be a radio news reporter. I was told it was going to be low pay, but I did it. But, as I family grew and now I have three kids, the pay just isn't there. And, of course, on the hours aren't always the greatest as well. So I think that's a big challenge right there when it comes to anyone wanting to get into that field and stay in it.
Great. Terry, thanks. Appreciate your perspective there. Terry pointing, this is not in, I think most cases, it's fair to say, right, this is not a high-paying field.
It's not. I was talking to someone the other day, and he said, I don't care about making... He's talking about wanting to be a journalist. And at one point, he said, I don't care about making money. I said, well, if you don't care about making money, you are in the right profession.
Is that, I don't know, is it something that could change?
I don't know. I mean, it's very competitive. A lot more people want to be journalists than can be, and so that's one of the things that depresses wages, and news organizations aren't raking in money the way that they used to, so that's another factor. I mean, there are people that come out of college and start their first journalism job who are making $22,000, $24,000 a year, sometimes even less than that. It's not a good paying profession, and it probably won't be in the future. But you know what? Most of the people who do it, that's not what's driving them, and it's not something that's going to keep them away from the job and from the profession.
So, Bill, we've had this discussion. This is something that's been weighing on you. You've been mulling this over. What would you tell a high school kid, if you were being completely honest, who came up to you and said, I want to be a journalist. Should I be a journalist? Looking into your crystal ball in the future, what do you see?
I would say all of the things that I told that group of students, that there are a lot of great things about it. You get to meet people that you would never otherwise meet. You get to tell people stories. You get to be with people in these moments that are just really pivotal in their lives, when terrible things happen to them or great things happen to them, or when that one thing happens to them that they say, I need a newspaper reporter, this is wrong. You know, it's tremendously gratifying. And you have a chance to, you know, to broaden your perspective about the world. You get to meet people from all persuasions. I don't know a single journalist who is as harsh in their assessment of politicians as are the politicians themselves. We're all more broad-minded, or most of us are more broad-minded in our assessment of the people in power than the people who are actually there, who are throwing mud pies at each other to get elected. So there's a lot of good things, but you know, you need to be aware that this is a very troubled time to be a journalist. There is not job security. People get thrown out of jobs. People are asked to leave jobs. And the more experience that you have, the more vulnerable you are. So that's a big negative.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Bill Leaders is associate editor at The Progressive Magazine, former money and politics director for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. His Milwaukee Magazine article about the challenges facing journalists today, it's linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.